All right, let's bring in Stephen Brunt from Sportsnet, a man who has spent a lot of time covering these Blue Jays and gotten to do some sit-down chats with people like Mark Shapiro, so has a very good sense of where this organization is at, what they are striving to achieve. First of all, thanks a lot for taking the time today, Stephen. Let's start with the George Springer move, because as much as attention that the Ryu signing got last offseason, this is, from a financial perspective and also probably from just a pure baseball perspective, the biggest move that this organization has made with Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins in charge. What was your reaction to the signing?
Yeah, well, it might be, hey, how you doing, number one. It may be the biggest move they've ever made, period. Like, never mind under Mark Shapiro, like, in terms of free agency, it has been tricky luring top of the market free agents to Toronto, you know, and there's you can kind of go down the list, and, you know, unless you want to go all the way back to 92, 93, when they had the highest payroll in baseball and winning those World Series, they brought in some guys at the end of their careers to kind of put them over the top, the Dave Winfields and Paul Molitor and Jack Morris and, you know, Dave Stewart and guys like that. But in terms of getting a guy right at the top of the market, yeah, it's never really happened before. You know, Ryu was a big signing last year. You know, the year they signed AJ Burnett and BJ Ryan when JP Ricciardi was running the team, that was a big thing. But this, I think this one kind of stands alone, to be honest. It's kind of a signature moment for the team.
Well, and Izzy touched on it, Stephen. During hockey season, it's hard to bump the Leafs off the front page. But I felt, even from Calgary here, listening to Toronto radio, that it became the number one story throughout most of this week. What do the Blue Jays get in Springer, and how does he change their lineup?
Well, he feels, you know, their biggest need in terms of position players was, you know, they talked about this going into the offseason, to the idea that they needed to become a better defensive team, run prevention, right? Which is not something we talk about a whole lot. But especially defense up the middle does make a difference. It, you know, makes your pitching staff better. It shortens games, does all kinds of things. So they did, and they didn't really have a natural center fielder on their roster. They had Randall Grichuk playing there, who's not a great defensive center fielder. They have Jonathan Davis, who's kind of a fourth outfielder, fifth outfielder guy who's very good defensively but not a good offensive player. And there was, you know, really one guy in this free agent market who is not just, you know, a very good, you know, a plus defensive center fielder, but also, you know, a really superb offensive player and a guy who's played on a good team and a championship team. You know, and Springer's he was the best position player in the market. So they, you know, they kind of shot high here, and I think that the market is weird this year. You know, it's obviously, look, we're in the middle of they had to just come off a shortened season with no fans. They're going to play maybe 162 this year, but nobody knows if they're going to sell any tickets. A lot of teams are backing off. Some of the normally aggressive teams in pre-agency are not. So, you know, I think the combination of the Jays and their ownership being willing to jump in here and get, you know, the best option for them, whatever it cost, combined with the fact that the market was a little bit softer than it would normally be, you know, it worked out for them. Like, George Springer costs you more in a non-pandemic situation, and I'm not sure the Jays get him.
You touched on ownership there, and that was one of the things I wanted to ask you, Steve, is, you know, at times we've seen the Jays go all in, and then at times it seems like they've sort of backed off. The question of what the payroll is going to be is always a big question in Toronto. What does this move and the financial commitment signify to you from what, you know, ownership and the Rogers family would like to see from this team going forward in the next, you know, 5 or 6 years?
Well, I think, first of all, it was made possible by the fact that they are a low payroll team right now because of the work that the front office has done over the last 2 or 3 years. This is a team of young, you know, some really exciting young players, but young players, guys who are not even arbitration eligible. So, you know, that cuts your financial, their financial obligations going into this offseason were minimal. And, you know, the some of the bad money that was left over from those, you know, very good teams in 2015 and 16 is gone. So you're not, you know, paying off the end of Troy Tulowitzki or Russell Martin. You know, you don't have obligations to guys who are, you know, where you're paying them for past performance. So they had a lot of wiggle room. This is a team that you know, was up to about $160 million in payroll when they had those two postseason appearances, and their obligations this year were like $70 million. So, you know, you've got a lot of, you had a lot of space, and that's by design, right? Like that's what you try to do, is draft well, develop well, build a young core, and then augment it with free agency rather than doing it the other way around. So they created a situation where, so it's not like they've had to set a new, put the bar in a new, a place where it's never been before. They're, you know, they're still going to come in. I still got a little work to do, but they're going to come in a little over $100 million in payroll this year, I think, and they're going to have a contending team. So, you know, it's not a bad deal for Rodgers. But, you know, the other part of it is that they've, you know, I think the ownership, which runs a publicly traded, you know, communication company, it's not a baseball company, and they, you know, they have to kind of look out for their shareholders by definition. So they're not going to do anything romantic, but they can see what happened in 2015 and 2016 when they won. You know, they can look at the stadium being full, and they can look at the TV numbers. So there's kind of a test case as to what happens if you have a winning baseball team in Toronto, you know, a recent test case. And, you know, the proof is there that if you do, you can make a lot of money. So, this, you know, it's investment spending. But, you know, you've got to give the front office credit for, you know, A, putting them in a position to do this, and B, communicating that to ownership effectively, right? Because that's always the dance with the Jays is, you know, you do have to sell them on things that are not guaranteed because sports isn't guaranteed.
Right. And even last year, it was overall a pretty encouraging season. But then if you were to analyze the 60-game season, there were some stretches where the offense wasn't great, where the bullpen wasn't great, where they were being carried by different parts of the team. And I guess you can get away with that in a 60-game season versus 162 games. When you look at this group now, Springer is obviously going to make a big difference either in the middle of the order or at the top of the order. There's still maybe some questions about the infield. There have been some bullpen arms added, but I think every team in baseball would take another 5 to 10 guys that would be potential bullpen options for them. And then, of course, the starting rotation. Where do you imagine the Blue Jays are targeting next, and just how high? I don't think anyone's expecting a Springer-type acquisition at any of those positions, but what kind of impact could a player bring to the team in any one of those spots?
Yeah, I think actually bullpen wise, they still might be an unbred hand, but I think the Yates signing is pretty significant. You know, a guy, you know, he had a physical issue last year, but before that, for the last 2 years before that, was a, you know, one of the best two or three relievers in baseball. So, you know, if he's healthy, that's a pretty good move. And, you know, Jordan Romano was very effective for the Jays when he was healthy last year, and Dolis was healthy, and these guys have done a really good job building bullpens out of, without spending any money. So, you know, the fact that they went in and spent some money this time, you know, they don't have Ken Giles now, obviously, because he's coming off Tommy John. He's a free agent now. But maybe, you know, they may still be in on Brad Hand, but they got a lot of arms. And we saw that even during the shortened season last year. Now, we saw a lot of guys who would have otherwise been pitching in the minors, but there was no minor leagues. But they do, I think they have the makings of a bullpen. But I think you'll see they need to add a starting pitcher, at least one. And I think it'll probably come, it probably won't be Trevor Bauer. It'll probably come from the next tier of guys who are out there, the Jake Odorizzi's, those kind of guys. Might be a trade, you know, which hasn't happened yet. They've got a lot of prospect capital they could wheel. And then I think they're going to have to figure out what they're going to do at third base. So, they had Shaw there last year, who wasn't great. Vladdy says he wants to go back and play there, but ideally they wouldn't do that. But I think, you know, there's some infielders kicking around. Simmons is kicking around. Colton Wong, you know, there's some infield options that might allow them to reconfigure their infield and get it and improve it defensively. So I would say I would expect them to sign a starting pitcher and an infielder, but at the very least. But I know there's been talk about them and Trevor Bauer, but that seems to me, you know, again, maybe the market will come back to them to the point where they say, what the heck, let's take a shot. But that seems to be a bridge too far as I can see.
Sportsnet's Stephen Brunt joining us on air. Last one for me, Stephen, before we switch to the NFL matchups this weekend. It was sort of noted and it raised a few eyebrows, the extension of Mark Shapiro being dropped on the first day of the NHL sort of return to play. Just wondering, sort of, was that coincidental? Is there more to read into that? Because I feel like the narrative on Shapiro and Atkins has started to shift and is, you know, seen through a much more favorable light right now.
I actually didn't think that, you know, it came out in the middle of the day on that day with a full blown Rogers press release with Edward Rogers quotes all over it. So it wasn't like they were pretending it didn't happen. And I'm trying to remember the last time there was an announcement about, you know, a president of the Toronto Blue Jays being extended. I can't remember one. You know, there haven't been a whole lot of presidents in the history of this team. You know, there's Peter Bavese, Paul Beeston, Paul Godfrey, Paul Beeston, Mark Shapiro. That's it. But it's not, you know, it's not like they spend a lot of time talking about the contract status of the guys in the front office publicly. They haven't. So, I'm not sure. I don't think they're trying to hide it, because why would you? And I think they're happy with him. You know, and they should be happy with him. He's done a really good job. You know, he came in and those guys came in, you know, he hired Ross Atkins, but they came in at a really, you know, tricky moment when Shapiro was hired to replace Beeston at a coming in, into the 2015 season when the team had been spinning its wheels for several years and didn't seem to be going anywhere. And then, you know, the magic happened halfway through that year. And so by the time he arrived, you know, Alex Anthopoulos was a folk hero in Toronto and everybody loved the Jays. And who were these guys? You know, it was awkward for reasons that are not his fault. But, you know, because of that, you know, even though they were back in the playoffs in 2016, there's one element in the fan base that was never going to accept them. But I think that element is diminished tremendously at this point. Because, look, from a baseball standpoint, it's hard to argue with what they've done. You know, again, the cleaning up the payroll, the roster that way, their drafts have been very successful. The development operation looks like it's doing a good job there. They've got a wave of young talent coming through the system. And then, they go out in the market and get Ryu last year, probably a year before anybody thought they would be aggressive for free agent. And then this year go out and sign the guy at the top of the market. So, you know, from a fan point of view, I'm not sure how you argue with that.
As Alex mentioned, we also want to get your thoughts on a pretty solid conference championship slate in the NFL. I think given the weird circumstances of this season, this is about as good as it could have gotten for the neutral NFL fan. On one side, two all-time quarterbacks. On the AFC side, two dynamic teams with young quarterbacks. What do you make of the teams that have made it to the conference championship, and what are you expecting out of the games on Sunday?
Yeah, it's not bad. Eh? Like, you've got, what, the last three MVPs, but probably the last four MVPs, because Rodgers will win it this year. You got two guys who are going to are already in the Hall of Fame, essentially, and three guys who are going to be in the Hall of Fame. It's not a bad mix. You know, dynamic young quarterbacks. It's been quite a spectacular playoff. I think, you know, it really has. It's weird, you know, in this weird year. You know, maybe we're spending more time as couch potatoes watching football than we normally would, but you can't argue with the matchups and the quality. I think they're two great, tremendously competitive football games. You know, I've been wrong on just about a lot of picks. You know, look, I live an hour and a bit away from the stadium, above the Bills Stadium in Orchard Park. I covered that team forever, all the four Super Bowl years and before that. And, you know, talk about a team that's ahead of schedule. But about five games or six games around the time of the Hail Mary, you know, just before and then after, started kind of thinking, well, actually, who's better than these guys? And I thought Baltimore would beat them. I thought Baltimore would beat them. And some things bounced their way in that game, obviously. Some things bounced their way in the Colts game. But, and now we'll see what kind of shape Mahomes is in. And I guess that's the X factor here. And, you know, in normal circumstances, you say, well, the Chiefs are the best team in the league and defending Super Bowl champions, and Mahomes is an impossible guy to defend. But, it's hard not to, you know, maybe this is my hometown thing showing a little bit, but I'm one of the people, a lot of people rooting for the Bills here. And you know, the long-suffering fans, they couldn't go in the stadium this year until the very end. But, boy, that fan base, this season has been a really, really happy surprise for them.
Yeah, their first conference championship since 1993. Stephen, correct me if I'm wrong. You were at Brady's first Super Bowl, correct, in New Orleans, 2001?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was. I was at all of them. Back in 2001, he was still the guy that, you know, the sixth round draft pick who stepped in, and unexpectedly took that team to the Super Bowl. And, you know, I think most people are still not fully convinced by him, even after he won that Super Bowl. But, and I've watched him this year. I thought last week that, you know, it wasn't quite like Peyton Manning at the end with the Broncos, where the Broncos won that Super Bowl and just carried him to the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, because he couldn't really play anymore. But, you know, you are seeing, you know, you see aspects of Brady that are different now, obviously, and as he heads to his mid-40s, you know, compared to that guy. But that's that Tampa team has all the elements. It just, you know, there are times this year when it just didn't gel, right, where they would play a great half and then a terrible half, and, you know, the offense would look out of sync. But, you know, they may be, you know, this may be that moment where I think on a talent basis they can play with Green Bay. And, you know, if at all, you know, they're going to miss Antonio Brown, but I think on a pure talent basis, they have every chance to win that game.
Looking at what Brady's done over his career, and now the fact that he's doing it with another franchise, because for so long he was tied at the hip with Bill Belichick, is there any athlete in sports that you can kind of compare to sort of the run and the longevity that Brady has had?
Oh boy, that's a tricky one. You know, like, there's, you know, so few guys that play as long as he's played. It just, in terms of quarterbacks, I was a Joe Montana guy. I was around for Montana's last Super Bowl. I love Joe Montana, and I, you know, that San Francisco team. And of course, you know, you mentioned the Bills' last AFC championship game. They beat Joe Montana, Kansas City Chief Joe Montana, in that game. So, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of Joe Montana's career, when he was sort of, you know, when he was diminished. I can convince that Tom Brady is the greatest quarterback who ever lived. I believe we've lived through the greatest era of quarterbacking that we ever will. You know, like, we have maybe the next iteration, maybe, you know, the Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes era will be just as good. But, you know, to think that, you know, we got to see Brady and Breeze and Manning, you know, and Aaron Rodgers and all these guys play, like, we got to see probably four of the best six quarterbacks in history play in the last 15 years, 20 years. You know, it's astounding. But, Brady to me is, and I, yeah, this year, you know, again, even though physically he's not quite the same guy, you know, the fact that he could go into a different situation without Belichick, without, albeit surrounded by better talent than he was surrounded with a lot of those years in New England. So don't forget that, right? Like, he hasn't had a receiving core this good. I don't think he ever had a receiving core this good. It may be the Randy Moss years, but I'm not sure he's had a receiving core this good at any time during that run with the Patriots.
Yeah, certainly, you know, a lot of weapons, and maybe he's not doing it quite the same way as he was doing it in that heyday with the Patriots, but he's made the throws when he's had to, and it makes for a really compelling championship Sunday. Stephen, thanks a lot for the time. We really appreciate it. Enjoy the games, and hope to talk to you soon, all right?
All right, take care, guys. Good talking to you.